Okay, good morning, everybody. Hanukkah Sameach, happy Hanukkah. And although our official topic is a kind of analytical halacha, we were doing Shemitah for a number of weeks, and we're going to continue with Shemitah, but we're taking a Hanukkah hiatus. And we're talking about Hanukkah last week and this week, maybe even next week, even though it's post-Hanukkah. And I wanted to share with you a few thoughts. Some of them are very technical halacha, which is our normal subject, and others are a little bit more general. And that is obviously the holiday of Hanukkah is commemorating a revolt against the Yavanim that were controlling Eretz Yisrael. And this revolt was led by Maccabi Hashmonaim. And we talked about it last week. I don't want to repeat everything, but just that you know the difference between Maccabim and Hashmonaim. They are not exactly the same. Hashmonaim are a family. Matisyahu and his five sons and their successors are Hashmonaim, because that was the name of the family. What does that family name mean? So many connected to the town in Eretz Israel that was called Hashmona, which is in the book of Yehoshua, or Hashmon, comes in two variations, and that was said to be the origin of the family. Now Maccabi, Maccabi is not a family name. Maccabi was actually, started off as the nickname that was appended to one of the Hashmonaim, Yehuda. It was called Yehuda HaMaccabi, but eventually it became the whole army. The whole Hasmonean army were called HaMaccabim. That's why the Book of the Maccabees actually goes by two names, and maybe a little confusing, but it's the same book. Sometimes it is called Sefer HaMaccabim, and sometimes it is called Sefer Hashmonaim. But that is the same thing. In fact, its original name was Sefer HaMaccabim. That's its real name. Sefer Hashmonaim was a later variation that was used. So Maccabi was originally a nickname for Yehuda, and then it became a name of the army as a whole. And as I said last week, there is a machlokes, what Maccabi even means, besides the Kupat Cholim in Yerushalayim that didn't exist then. Some say Maccabi is an abbreviation, Mi Kamocha Ba'elim Hashem. This is taken from Uz Yashir in the Torah, who is like you among the powers, God. And the Rashi Tevos of Mi Kamocha Ba'elim Hashem is Mem Chaf Beis Yod. And that was their banner. Their banner was, in God we trust, so to speak. It's only Hashem that gives victory. And the other interpretation is that Maccabi is the Lashon of Makevet. Makevet is a term in Tanakh that is a sledgehammer. And it refers to their ferocity as warriors. Now, there's a big difference practically between the two interpretations. Do you spell Maccabi with a chaf or Maccabi with a kuf? Because if it's Mi Kamocha Ba'ilam Hashem, it would be a chaf or a kuf, just like the Kupat Cholim spells it that way. If, on the other hand, it's Makevet, which means sledgehammer, you would spell it with a kuf. So you might say, so let's just see how it's spelled in the Book of the Maccabees. The Book of the Maccabees was written around the Hanukkah story. The answer is, we do not have the original Hebrew Book of the Maccabees. In fact, we don't even know if it was originally written in Hebrew. The only Book of the Maccabees we have from going back to the time is Greek. The Hebrew, now you can get a Hebrew translation, but any Hebrew translation you have is a recent, now when I say recent, I don't mean yesterday, but it's within the past 200 years. So essentially in Greek, you cannot tell from the word Maccabi how it would have been spelled in Hebrew. So as a result, we have a machlok. And the Book of the Maccabees doesn't tell you why they're called Maccabees. So the most you can look at is the letters. And looking at the Greek alphabet, you would not know what the corresponding Hebrew letter would be. And that's why we have a machlok. So be sure you know the difference between Hashmonaim and Maccabim. Now, a little bit further about this. The books that are called Books of the Maccabees or Sefer HaMaccabim, there's actually four. That's, you know, just like we have in Tanakh, Malachim Aleph, Malachim Beis, although those were later, actually Christian introductions. So too, we have Maccabim Aleph, Maccabim Beis, Maccabim Gimel, Maccabim Dalet. Now, it's important to know that the the most complete and reliable historical source of the war against the Yavanim is Maccabim Aleph. Maccabim Aleph is the primary historical record of the struggles of the Maccabees against the Yavanim. And that's important to know. Maccabees Beis, written by somebody else. Everything's anonymous. We have no idea who the author of any of these books are. Maccabim Beis rehashes a lot of the detail, but it has a different emphasis. Again, forgive me for repeating a little bit. And that is, Maccabim Aleph emphasizes military victories. Maccabim Beis talks a lot about martyrdom, the people who were willing to die, Al Kiddush Hashem, such as Chana and her seven sons. And I think I mentioned last week that this mirrors a modern controversy regarding Yom HaShoah. Do you glorify the Warsaw Ghetto who fought, or do you glorify the people who went to their deaths with dignity and Kedusha, Al Kiddush Hashem? Now, as far as I'm concerned, you honor both, but I think I pointed out that the fact that the State of Israel made Holocaust Memorial Day Yom HaShoah in the month of Nisan to correspond to the fall of the Warsaw Ghetto was in the 1940s and 50s we don't think about it so much today, but it was a very politically charged issue because many of the Holocaust survivors thought this was an implied rejection. And sometimes it wasn't implied, sometimes it was explicit. Rejection of the passivity of the Jews who went to their death as sheep, and people were even ashamed of them, God forbid, and therefore we have to glorify the warriors. That's exactly the machlokas, I think, between Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2. Now, Maccabees 3 and 4, just so you get a picture, are not so much historical. They are actually somewhat philosophical books. And they discuss the issues. It's almost like it's structured as a dialogue between a Hellenist philosopher and a religious Jew, in which they kind of discuss, why are you keeping these old laws? They don't make sense, etc. So it just kind of, you can look at it as an appendix to the historical books by laying out the religious and ethical and moral case. So Maccabees 3 and 4 are not considered historical books at all. They're essentially philosophical books. Now, I had mentioned that obviously Sefer HaMaccabim is not part of Tanakh. It was written, the whole Hanukkah story is after the loss of prophecy. It's the end of the, so it's after the biblical period. And they're called Svarim Chitzonim. Svarim Chitzonim means the excluded books, which is actually the meaning of the word Apocrypha. The word Apocrypha is a Greek term for that which is hidden. Okay, that which is hidden. It's a Greek term, Svarim Chitzonim, the excluded books. Now, what was Chazal's attitude towards these excluded books? And there are quite a lot. Sefer Maccabim is only one of many. So on one hand, we have a statement in the Gemara that says, anybody who reads Svarim Chitzonim, ein lo chelek le'olam haba. If you read Svarim Chitzonim, you lose your olam haba. Keep away from it, it's treif. On the other hand, one of the Svarim Chitzonim is a book called Ben Sira. Ben Sira was the author. His name was Yehoshua Ben Sira. Often you'll see in English things, it'll be called Jesus Ben Sira. But Jesus is not a scary name. I just want to clarify this. Jesus is simply the Greek for Yehoshua. Yashka's name was Yehoshua. For some reason, Christians like to call him Yeshua, but Yeshua itself appears in Tanakh as a contraction for Yehoshua. Yeah. Yeshua is not only, right, yeah, yeah. So he's called Yeshua, right? So Yeshua is not a sinister name. And Jesus is not, if you looked at the Greek translation of the Tanakh, it would say Jesus, whatever the Greek is, son of Nun, So Jesus is just Yehoshua, that's all it is. So the author of the book Ben Sira was Yehoshua Ben Sira. And the book of Ben Sira is very, very similar to Mishlei, to Proverbs. It's words of wisdom, words of Musar. And Chazal, now it's not considered holy because it's not prophetic, but it's like it's holy in the way that any Musar book is holy. A person can write a Musar book today and it would have an element of holiness because it's based on the Torah. So Ben Sira is holy in the same way that a Musar book written by a great person would be holy, but it doesn't have the Kedusha of Kisvei HaKodesh. And Chazal quotes Ben Sira. for its wisdom and for its guidance. So how do you understand the statement that if you read Sfarim Chitzonim, you don't have a share in the world to come, when Chazal themselves quote approvingly, sometimes they're critical of it, but approvingly generally of Ben Sira? So the answer is, Sfarim Chitzonim themselves come in different varieties. And when Chazal said, if you read Sfarim Chitzonim, you don't have a share in the world to come, they didn't mean everything in the Apocrypha, but certain books in the Apocrypha. So in point of fact, you can divide the Apocrypha into three categories. And number one are works of history, such as the Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2. Works of history are fine. They give you the history of the period. And even if they're not prophetic, they give you the detail. Now, again, for most of us, Maccabees 1 gives you more detail than you might be interested in. It goes over every single, if you're a military buff, you would enjoy it a lot. It goes over every single military campaign in great, great, great detail. I think I had mentioned that in West Point, they actually read the Book of the Maccabees because it's an ancient example, fascinatingly, of guerrilla warfare of an untrained small group of soldiers against a massive professional army. And it shows that the guerrilla warfare can win. And if you are old enough to remember Vietnam, that was exactly the situation that the United States faced in Vietnam. I mean, technically, we don't call it a defeat, but everyone knows the United States essentially was defeated in Vietnam by people who were just totally, very, very backwards in terms of technology and everything else. And part of the what West Point started doing is they started learning the Book of the Maccabees to see how could this guerrilla work. So be it as it may. So category one of the Apocrypha are books of history. Category two are kind of general books of ethics that are consistent with the teachings of the Torah. There you really only have one big example, that's Ben Sira. But there is a category three that Chazal were very, very suspicious of. And these were books that were written by deviant sects like the Tzedukim or the Essenes, similar to the Dead Sea Scroll people, although the Dead Sea Scroll books are not necessarily part of the Apocrypha, but they emerged from movements that denied the oral law, that denied the Torah Shebaal Peh, and it was very concerned with various apocalyptic visions about Mashiach. And in fact, it's been shown very, very much that those apocryphal books either influenced Christianity or they were, depending on, influenced by Christianity, depending on the dating of the particular books. And those were the books that Chazal felt a religious Jew should not necessarily look at, because they contained ideas that, again, like the Essenes, these different movements that deny Torah Shebaal Peh. So even when you see a statement in the Gemara, anyone who reads the Sfarim Chitzonim does not have a share in Olam Haba, you do have to understand it doesn't mean everything. In fact, the Rishonim, like Rashi, Ramban, they quote from Sefer HaMakabim, apparently. Well, okay, I guess I do have to qualify. I said that the Hebrew translations are modern. There were Hebrew translations in the Middle Ages as well, but they were translations from the Greek, meaning to say the original Hebrew text, if there even was an original Hebrew text, and we don't even know that, we never had. Therefore, anyone that quotes the Book of the Maccabees from a Hebrew is quoting a translation from Greek. Yeah, it's an interesting little paradox that the Maccabees who fought against the Greeks, that the Book of the Maccabees should be written in Greek. Well, yeah, that's what happened to the Hashmonaim themselves. Now, let me mention another historical source of Hanukkah that's kind of very, very interesting. Maybe you've seen in a siddur, some siddurim have it, something called Megillas Antiochus. Have you ever seen that? Megillas Antiochus. This is not like the Book of the Maccabees, that's a big book. Megillas Antiochus is like the size of Megillas Esther, and you can see the parallel, that many shuls, less so today, I'm sure there are some in Yonim that do it, but I'm not aware of any mainstream kehillah that doesn't. But in the Middle Ages, it was very, very popular thing that the same way on Purim, we read the Megillah of Esther, which is of course a book in Tanakh, there was a parallel document called Megillas Antiochus, that talks about the story of Hanukkah, and it was actually read in Shul's without a bracha. There was no bracha that was recited because it's not a chiyuv. It even parallels linguistically Megillas Esther. Megillas Esther begins Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh, and it was Nei Achashverosh. So it says Vayhi b'mei Antiochus. A lot of the language parallels it, and it gives you the Hanukkah story. Some Siddurim still have it, even though almost no shul that I know reads it, but they do have it. So if you have a Siddur that has it, you know, you may want to read. Now, there's a huge machlokas. Again, the author is anonymous. We don't know who the author is. But there's a huge machlokas how old Megillas Antiochus is. There are actually some views that say it is as old as the story of Hanukkah itself. It was actually written all the way back. Meaning to say, it is actually even earlier than Maccabees. It is the earliest story of Hanukkah. And some say exactly the opposite. It was a late Middle Ages rewriting of the Book of Hanukkah based on Midrashim and based on the Book of Maccabees. It was just like a later thing that somebody wrote. So it's so interesting. You'll mamish see Mikatzeh LaKatzeh, that some look at it as the most accurate historical source of the events. And some say it has no accuracy at all. I mean, in other words, it's totally based on other sources and there's no particular credence. Now, if you ever have the time and effort, I'm trying to do a little of this myself. It's a very, very fascinating to compare the different versions of the Hanukkah story. The version in Sefer HaMakabim 1 and the version in Sefer HaMakabim 2, and then the story of Megillas Antiochus. And then we have two Midrashim about Hanukkah, which are not in the mainstream Midrashim, but they're both Medrash L'Hanukkah and Medrash L'Hanukkah. Oh. There are many, many small Midrashim that got lost or they're only preserved in different ways. There was a fellow, actually.
What's the Gemara?
Huh? There is a Gemara, yeah. The Gemara in Shabbos is a single brisa,
right.
That is quotes.
It's history.
Right, it gives a little bit of the history. I'll talk about that, and then you see the differences in the stories. There was a fellow, very interesting fellow. I think he died maybe in the 1920s. His name was Yehuda David Eisenstein. I don't know if you ever came across the name. Yehuda David Eisenstein. Yeah, I don't know a lot about him. He came from Europe and he settled in America. In America in those days, you know, no yeshivas, no anything. He was an extremely learned person, learned not only in Torah, but interested in secular things and the like. In fact, and he just wrote a lot. I mean, he probably sold almost nothing and he kind of lived in poverty, but he just devoted his life to a scholarship. And he wrote an early Jewish encyclopedia in Hebrew called Otsar Yisrael, which maybe in some libraries you can actually find. And he wrote all sorts of anthologies. In those days, like who even bought, you know, I mean, who even bought it? He wrote Hebrew anthologies on everything. So one of his many, many anthologies, is something called Otsar HaMidrashim. And you can get this on Hebrew Books Online. You can actually see this for free. And Otsar HaMidrashim, now we know the main Midrashim, Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma, these are the famous Midrashim that have never gone out of print. But Otsar HaMidrashim is a collection of all sorts of lost and obscure Midrashim that were only preserved in some places and not in other places, and they never were really printed, but somehow he had access to manuscripts and other collections. And Otsar HaMidrashim collects all of these like little unknown Midrashim, and in his Otsar HaMidrashim he has two sections called Medrash Hanukkah Aleph, version Aleph, and Medrash Hanukkah version Beis. And each medrash is around 5 pages. And again, since these are not the official midrashim, we're not even sure how authoritative they are, but Rishainim use them. Rishainim quote them, Rashi and the like. And there is another source, the Yotzros. Now, the Yotzros were piyutim that were added in Birchos Kriyashman in the Shmona Esrei. And Yotros are almost extinct. They're an extinct genre. Almost nobody says them. The great Kehila that still says them are the Yekis. If you're an authentic Yeki, the German Reich, you will say Yotros all the time. Yotros for the 4 Parshiots, Yotzros for Chanukah, Yotzros for Parshas Bereishis. Amazing. Now, among other non-Yekki congregations, Yotzros are dead. The only time we say Yotzros are Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We say those piyutim. But you have to understand, those extra poems that we say in Chazaras Hashatz, and we associate them in our mind to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Now, of course, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, of course, has unique Yotzros. Yeah. But Yotzros were not limited to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur davening. Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot, Lag BaOmer. If there's a Brisson show, there were Yotzros that were said. Hanukkah, Purim, all sorts of things. Again?
Then it makes them no tachanun less exciting.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Because you have all sorts of other things to say. And it's a chaval because Yotzros contain a wealth of information. They allude to many, many midrashim that we've lost. And the Yotzros of Chanukah are very, very fascinating because they also allude to all sorts of midrashic teachings that are kind of based on these lost midrashim. But, you know, it's hard to even find. Where will you find the Yotzros for Chanukah? Not in a regular Seder. A regular Seder, you're not going to. So maybe if you get a German Seder, you go to Washington Heights, or, you know, in Eretz Yisrael too, we have some Kehilos that follow Minhag Ashkenaz. The Otzer HaTfilos, which is a great, wonderful two-volume Seder with many, many commentaries. At the end of volume two, almost as an appendix, it has Yotzros for Chanukah. And some recent Svarim. I mean, I know there's a... There are people who are trying to go back to Piyutim, and they're teaching them and giving commentaries on them and explaining the allusions and the like. So I'm not sure if Piyutim are going to be revived, but nevertheless, at least they're being reclaimed to some degree. Chassidim say it for the Dalit Parshios. Yeah.
And
Yom Tov. Yeah. Chanukah, I think not. Chanukah, yeah.
Elizabeth is the only place I've ever been where they say it for the Arvot Parshios, I have to say.
Well, I tell you, I remember, I mean, I grew up in a Young Israel, right. Young Israel of Hartford, and we used to say the Yotzros of the Dalit Parshios. I mean, I do remember this. Yeah. So some things, even in my own lifetime, you know, have gotten virtually extinct. I remember, by the way, I remember another thing. And for years, I convinced myself that my memory must have been incorrect. I distinctly remember, like as a nine-year-old, seeing religious people turn on electric lights on Yom Tov. I had a memory of seeing people, from people, turn on lights. But then, you know, everywhere I went, it was Usher. It was obviously Usher.
Right.
So I figured to myself, you know, sometimes you have a memory and you just figure the memory is incorrect. But in point of fact, there were many who matyred, not on Shabbos. Shabbos has other reasons, right. But they considered electricity equivalent to transferring fire. Mm-hmm. And there were many people who did matir turning on lights on Yom Tov. And this was actually followed, at least in the United States, it was followed by many religious people. But as they say, I'm not saying that it should be good or should be not good, but all I'm saying is, practically, it's extinct today. A religious person, Bederach Klal, is not going to turn on an electric light.
Well, it's not about phone now versus...
Well, that's a machlokish generally. I mean, even on Shabbos. I mean, that's not a topic. Right. I mean, what is the issue?
But if you hold the Tavara, then it's not an issue.
Even if it's Havara, it's an issue because it's turning on a light, creating a new flame, and transfer. I mean, that's an issue too.
Right.
I mean, electricity generally is very, very controversial. I mean, again, the bottom line is we don't do it. You know, we don't turn on. But to actually discuss why is very, very far from Pashut. It's, you know, the thing that we teach kids that you're starting a fire, you know, Lapdavka, that may not be the reason. The Chazon Ish talked about building, you're joining the circuit. Yeah. Shlomo Zalman said it was an Isher Derabanan of creating new things. It wasn't even a Daraisa, which is a Derabanan. And in fact, the Chazon Ish was quoted as, not quoted, but somebody, this was a private thing. He never wrote this and he never said it publicly. But it's a fascinating statement about the halachic process.
Yeah.
The Chazon Ish said, it's not Pashut that electricity should be Usher and Shabbos. You know, it's not Pashut that it should be Usher at all. But he said, But it has to be usher.
Right.
Because if it's not going to be usher, we've turned Shabbos into chol. Well, and therefore, we are mechuyev to find the halachic reason. Now, this is the opposite of how you would normally understand the halachic process. I mean, we criticize people on the left as saying, oh, they have a result that they want, and then they look for the reason. But the truth of the matter is...
No, I see that on both. Huh? You see it everywhere.
Yeah, but the Chazon Ish to say... But the Chazon Ish is essentially saying the same thing. And again, the concept is that a gadol at least can understand that maturing a certain thing would be so destructive to the holiness of Shabbos that we're kind of obligated to look for a reason to make it us.
It's almost like,
and this is what he said.
It's almost like it has echoes of like the hall.
Yes. Okay. That's correct.
But the other is when Shabbos clocks came out. Also, people were very.
Reb Moshe was against Shabbos clocks, but Reb Moshe had a very logical argument. Reb Moshe's argument is, if the Chachamim prohibited telling a goy to do work on Shabbos, even though a goy doesn't have a mitzvah of Shabbos, Reb Moshe's argument was having a machine do your work on Shabbos should be nichlal to having a goy do your work on Shabbos, and therefore it's improper. But Reb Moshe said he wasn't going to stop it for lights because the minhag had already been accepted that way. But Reb Moshe's pesach overall, we don't accept. I mean, say again?
The things that make noise.
Things that make noise is another problem. Dishwashers. Yeah, right. Dishwashers is a classic example. That's a mashmiya kol, and that's a bizayon. That's called a public bizayon of Shabbos. That's a separate issue. But Rav Moshe's psak about timers was not accepted. Again, everybody loves Rav Moshe when he is lenient. But Rav Moshe, when he's machmir, we say, oh, we don't follow Rav Moshe.
But sometimes like halacha seems to be like almost like bottom, like instead of top down. Like sometimes it ends up being like bottom up, not top.
That's very true. That's very true. Sometimes.
My brother likes to say.
Yeah. No, that's very, very true. In fact, talk about bottom down. I don't want to digress too much. My wife tells me she once went to a women's shir that Rav Scheinberg Zatzal was giving. And this was a Q&A. People would ask him, Shilas. So listen to the story. So a woman said, if I'm in someone's house and I have a headache and the house has aspirin from the Kupat Cholim for their medical needs or whatever it is, are they allowed to give me, I think a very firm question, are they allowed to give me an aspirin since it was given to them by the Kupat Cholim only for them? So they're not allowed to give it to somebody else. So Rav Scheinberg started thinking, no, you're right, there's a Shaila, it might be Gezela, because it was given to you for a specific purpose and you're using it for a different purpose. So the Rebbetzin Scheinberg came and said, are you telling me that I'm not allowed to give somebody an aspirin? He says, that's not possible. So Rav Scheinberg said, okay, I'm going to have to rethink this. So I think that's an example of a bottom. Rebbetzin says, not shayach, right? So you got to rethink what the Pesach Halacha is going to be in such a case. Okay, so be it as it may, I want to share with you the following historical observation that may sound like just a historical observation, but I think it's extremely powerful. Most of us assume that at the end of this struggle against the Yavanim, we regained the Beis HaMikdash, right? We purified the temple, we found the oil, and we defeated the Yavanim and we established the Jewish state under the Hashmonah. We think, in other words, that the dedication of the Mikdash was the end of the military struggle against the Yavanim. That's the picture we have in our minds. Now, I have to be honest, the Rambam does seem to describe it that way. The Rambam seems to say, we defeated the Yavanim, we dedicated the temple, we found the oil. And in fact, the Rambam even says, the celebration of Hanukkah, amazingly enough, is the reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty. Talk about Yom HaTzmut. That's very, 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 very fascinating. The Rambam says, Machzir ribonot liYisrael karov lemasayim shana. That Jewish sovereignty was established. That's very, very fascinating. The Rambam actually puts the Hanukkah celebration in political terms. But historically, what the Rambam is suggesting is the Hanukkah Sabayis and the military victory occurred at the same time. However, many, many Makoros, including the Book of the Maccabees, paint a very, very different picture. The regaining of the Beis HaMikdash after 3 years of desecration was, of course, very, very joyous. But it was not the end of the struggle. The struggle against Antiochus, Antiochus was then killed, but you know, his successors, lasted for more than 20 years until Shimon was able to proclaim himself or be proclaimed Nasi Yisrael. Which means, in other words, the Chanukah Sabayis and even the miracle of the oil was not at the at the end of the struggle. It was towards the beginning of the struggle. Now, you might say, okay, I mean, why, okay, I mean, unless you're interested in history, why is that particularly important? I think it sheds, no pun intended, it sheds a whole new light on the spiritual significance of Chanukah. And having it when it happens makes it much more powerful. Imagine that you're a Maccabee, you're a Chashmonai, whatever it is, and you're a small group of people, untrained, not really armed, not used to warfare, and you're fighting really the most powerful army in the world, the Greek Empire, the Seleucid Greek Empire. And, you know, the odds are overwhelmingly against you. And not only that, but your own people think you're crazy. They think you're fanatic. The Chashmonaim did not have support from most of the Jewish people. Most of the Jewish people were already Hellenists, either, even before Antiochus, either they did it voluntarily or they broke down because of compulsion, either way. And they thought, because remember, Antiochus was offering, you know, something that on one level is a good deal. Get rid of your Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh and Kashrus. Be like us, and you will have the wealth of the world that is open to you. And on Sunday, went through Shir HaShirim, which has many psukim about the enticements of the world. So you're a Chashmonai, and you're getting up every day to wage a battle against unbelievable odds. You have no support from anybody. You're beleaguered. You're under attack. Your life is threatened. The lives of your wives and children are in constant jeopardy. At some point, you just give up. At some point, the struggle seems hopeless. And if you really want to keep the mitzvahs, let's go to a cave privately. What are we fighting then? We'll go to the caves and we'll keep our mitzvahs in private. So let's look at the miracle of the Nevus. They cleanse the Beis HaMikdash. All of the oil is tamei, so it shouldn't be used. Although that raises fascinating halachic problems, because technically, if they wouldn't have found pure oil, they would have been allowed to use impure oil, because for communal offerings, you're allowed to use tamei, but they didn't want to use it if they didn't have to. And they find a jar of oil that was uncontaminated, not tamei, sealed with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. And it's only one day. And they light it. First of all, that itself is a futile gesture. What's the use of lighting one day's oil if tomorrow it's gone? But what happens with that oil? That oil, which was only one day, burns for 8 days. If I'm a Maccabee, what's that telling me? That the light that you can create in this world, even if you think it's meaningless, it's ineffectual, it's not going to do anything. You do what you can, and Hashem will bless your efforts beyond what you thought possible. Think about what this message meant at the beginning of a struggle. Think of what it means. If this would have been at the end of the struggle, it would have been a nice frosting on top of the cake. Yeah, Baruch Hashem, Hashem did another miracle. But in the middle of the war, this is Hashem telling you, don't give up. Keep on going. You think your efforts don't count. You think your efforts are going to fail. You do what you can in the cause of holiness, and I will step in and give you success. I think it's extraordinarily moving that this is Hashem giving him that hope in the middle of a protracted struggle that will go on for many, many years. And this is a message that was not only relevant to the Chashmonaim, it's a message relevant to us. Because we live in a world that is surrounded by so much darkness on all levels. There is the darkness, just as the Greek period is called dark, of assimilation, of ignorance of Torah, of rejection of Torah, of immorality, of hedonism. There is the darkness of violence and bloodshed in the world. There is the darkness of immorality, both financial, sexual, every other form of immorality. There is the darkness of illness, COVID and non-COVID. There is the personal darkness that people have of depression and despair and marital estrangement and the estrangement of parents and children. Darkness comes in many, 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 many forms, individual, communal, psychological, spiritual, physical, all types of darkness. And each of us has a job by Hashem. Babaji Rebbe used to talk about the fact that a Jew has to be a lamplighter. What was a lamplighter? Before they had electricity. So the job was to light the lamps, light the gas lamps every night. A Yid is supposed to be a person who brings light into the world. But we ask ourselves, the darkness is so thick. The darkness is so big. What can my little insignificant light possibly do? What is Chanukah saying? Chanukah says, light your little light that is insignificant and puny and not able to last. But you do what you can. And I will bless it. And I will give it a key. I will give it a way that it will make a difference. I mean, what a magnificent message that is for every one of us who lives in a world that is filled with darkness. But Hashem gave us the capacity to try to generate a little bit of light in that world. And even when we think it's not possible, we'll be given Hatzlacha. So what I'm suggesting is that I think is the very, very deep significance of why the history matters here. Putting the nais of the Pach HaShemen towards the beginning rather than towards the end makes it not a confirmation of a fait accompli, but a message of hope for the struggle that the Jewish people will be facing for more than 20 years. But as I say, the history here is murky. The Rambam, now again, the Rambam is not necessarily a definitive historian. The Rambam's understanding of the events seems to be that everything happened, the Beis Hamikdash, the Chanukah Sabayas, and the Nitzachon over the Yavanim happened all at the same time. But again, we don't know if the Rambam had access to Sefer HaMakabim. Sefer HaMakabim puts it different. Now, so I talked about the Maccabees, I talked about Megillas Antiochus, I talked about the Midrashim, I talked about the Yotros. Let me mention the Braisa in the Gemara itself. The Gemara itself has a Braisa about Chanukah. This is in the second parak of Maseches Shabbos. Now, first of all, what is Braisa? This is something to think about as well. There is no such thing as a book of Braisos. Where are Braisos from? Braisa is a word of exclusion. It is not a definition. Braisa means outside. Any teaching of the Tanayim that is not in the Mishnah is called a Braisa. So Braisa is just telling you what something isn't. It isn't telling you what something is. Like, where do you find Braisos? So again, you find the Braisa in any work of the Tanaim that is not the Mishnah. So many Braisos are from the Tosefta, which was an appendix to the Mishnah. Many Braisos are from the Halachic Midrashim, like the Mechilta. So when the Gemara says Tanya, we learned in a Braisa. Usually the Gemara is getting the Braisa from some book, but it doesn't tell you what that book is. Sometimes it tells you on the side they put in, sometimes they don't tell you. but it's a Tosefta. It's from a halachic medrash, like the Mechilta on Shemos, or the Sifra on Vayikra, or the Sifri on Bamidbar Devarim. Now, sometimes there are what you might call brises of unknown origin, meaning to say the Amoraim had access to collections of teachings of Tanaim that we cannot trace to somewhere else, meaning we only know it because the Gemara quotes it, but we don't know where the Gemara got the brisa from. Because as I say, brisa is not a definition of what something is. It just tells you what it's not. It's not a teaching of the Mishnah. Now, the brisa of the story of Hanukkah, we know that where that comes from. That actually comes from a work of the Tanaim that is more than 100 years earlier than the Mishnah. And that is called Megillas Tanis. This is a brisa from Megillas Tanis. Now, what is Megillas Tanis? This is a confusing name. Literally, it means the scroll of fasting. So if you had to guess what it was, you'd figure, oh, it's probably a compendium about the laws of fasting. No, it's actually the opposite. It is a list of holidays where you're not allowed to fast because they are eulogized, because they are joyous events. Now, it's a little strange because the things that are joyous under Torah law are not mentioned in Megillas Tanis. Megillas Tanis does not mention Yom Tov, Rosh Chodesh, because those are days you're not allowed to fast under the law of the Torah. But it mentions many, many days which commemorate happy events during the Second Temple period. And we don't observe these days today because Chazal tell us lahalacha, once the destruction of the Second Temple occurred, the festive days of Megillat Tanis became batel. So all sorts of days. In fact, Itzom Gedalia, I mean, the third of Tishrei was a happy festive day. Tanis Esther, the 13th of Adar, was a happy festive day. So, but the idea is that, you know, we can fast on those days. And in fact, we do fast on those days because once they have the Korban, Megillat Tanis no longer applies. However, there are two holidays in Megillat Tanis that we still observe. Purim. Of course, it's a little bit of a problem why Purim is included there because Purim is a biblical, it's not Torah law, but it's in Tanakh, and Hanukkah. And the story of Hanukkah in the Gemara is lifted from the Megillat Tanit, a narrative. Now, in the Megillat Tanit narrative, it does not emphasize the military victory at all. It mentions it. It says, and when we were victorious over the Yavanim, that's all it says. When we were victorious over the Yavanim, that's all it says about the victory. We then found the jar of oil and we lit the candles for 8 days. So I think it's fair to say that although Megillat Tanit does not deny the victory over the Yavanim, you know, it mentions it, but it does not emphasize it. And it seems to connect Hanukkah celebration to the miracle of the Pach HaShemesh. Now, here is the interesting point. Megillat Tanit was written almost 300 years after the Hanukkah story. In other words, let's look at this. The Mishnah was compiled around the year 200 of the Common Era. These are approximate dates. Megillat Tanit was written around 100 years earlier. So that gets you into 100 of the Common Era, which is 30 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The story of Hanukkah, again, all dating is very uncertain, but the Hanukkah Sabayis occurred around 165 BCE. So from 165 BCE to 100 CE is 265 years, Berech 300 years, whatever. So the Megillat Tanis narrative was hundreds of years after the Hanukkah story, as opposed to the Book of the Maccabees, which was contemporaneous with the Hanukkah story, and some say even Megillat Antiochus, some say was contemporaneous with the Hanukkah story. So here is an interesting point that I want to suggest. Hanukkah has many, many themes. There's a military victory. There's Jewish independence. There is the most important thing, the reestablishment of Torah and mitzvot and avodas Hashem. the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash that had been desecrated, the rededication, the miracle of the Pach HaShemen, all of these are reasons for celebration, reasons for joy, reasons for gratitude. And no one is denying it. No one is saying, you know, this didn't happen or whatever. But the question becomes, what are the things that you emphasize in the Chag? So I would suggest to you, it's not my chiddush, and we know other people have pointed out, that there may have been a Chanukah version 1 and a Chanukah version 2. The Chanukah version 1 was primarily a celebration, as the Rambam writes, of Jewish independence, dedication of the Beis HaMikdash. And again, as I say, Jewish independence, not as a value in and of itself, but in order to keep the Torah. We're not denying that. But version number 2 de-emphasized all of those ideas and preferred to focus on the miracle of the Neros. And there may be a number of reasons for that. Number one, at the time of Megillat Tanis, we were under Roman domination. The Romans had destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. There were gezeiros against Jews. To celebrate a holiday that talks about overthrowing foreign domination would be a very, very dangerous thing. Remember, the Romans looked at us as troublemakers already, because they originally thought, in fact, rightly or wrongly, the Jews gave them much more of a tough time than they imagined. They didn't think that they would be involved in all of these wars. And of course, with Bar Kokhba, was even worse. In fact, just from an economic standpoint, we tied up Roman resources like more excessively than any other colonization in the entire Roman Empire. So one had to tread very softly and not parading, you know. That's why Yashka was crucified. I mean, the story goes that Erev Pesach was the worst day of the year for the Romans, because you had millions of Jews in Yerushalayim, and the Jews hated the Romans. And if a guy shows up and says, "I'm king of the Jews, I'm Mashiach," the Romans would kill him immediately. You couldn't, because they really thought this would be a spark in a truck of gasoline that would just explode. So by the time of the Mishnah, certainly Megillas Tanis, we couldn't emphasize that aspect of it. That doesn't mean it didn't exist, again, but it means, what do you emphasize and the like. So it is very fascinating that Megillat Tanit has a different emphasis for the holiday of Chanukah than the Sefer HaMakabim. But the good news basically is that Baruch Hashem, we live at a time in which we're able to incorporate all of these different themes. And thus the Alei Nisim does talk about the victory to reestablish the Torah. And of course, we celebrate the miracle of the Neros by lighting. And as I explained, the miracle of the Neros itself ties into the victory, because that gave us the chizuk to persevere. One final thing I want to mention, which again is kind of an unrelated point, but it's a point that's still a little problematical. Alei Nisim identifies Matisyahu. Right? Matisyahu was a very old man, and he died at the beginning. He was the spiritual inspiration for the revolt, but he died shortly afterwards. I mean, he did not carry out any military operations. His sons did the work, yeah. And he died. But it mentions, Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmina Yuvana. So The description here is actually a little complicated to parse. When it says, in the days of Matisyahu, the son of Yochanan, Kohen Gadol, what on whom is Kohen Gadol going on? Does it mean Matisyahu was Kohen Gadol? Or is it Yochanan Kohen Gadol?
His father.
His father. So the truth of the matter is, or both. So the truth of the matter is, different midrashim go in different directions. We don't really have evidence that Matisyahu himself was a Kohen Gadol. We do, however, know of Yochanan Kohen Gadol. But here is the fascinating thing. Yochanan the Kohen Gadol is mentioned several times in the Gemara, and we're not always sure if it's the same person, because we have two contradictory bits of information about it, which is quite complicated. One is, he was a Kohen Gadol for 80 years and he became a tzaduki at the end of his life. The other is, Yochanan Kohen Gadol made a number of takanos to strengthen Jewish religious observance, such as demai. Demai is the halacha that you must take truma and meiser from the grain that you buy from an amoretz. So, is this the same Yochanan Kohen Gadol? In other words, in his 80 years, he did some good stuff, and then he became a tzaduki.
But
that wasn't Shimon. No, it's not Shimon. It's Yochanan Kohen Gadol. No, the Shimon Tzadik didn't become a tzaduki. So number one, is this the same Yochanan Kohen Gadol? And number two, is it Matisyahu's father or somebody later? Because there were descendants of Matisyahu, whose name was Yochanan. Matisyahu had a son, Yochanan, but they were also later in this. Right? So there's a lot of uncertainty here. A lot of uncertainty. The Rambam actually says it's clear that Matisyahu's father was a tzaddik, and the Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who became a tzaduki, is a later descendant.
Wow.
But on the other hand, just from an emotional level, and I guess you shouldn't decide historical matters based on emotion, I find something very powerful in the fact of what gave Matisyahu the impetus to start this revolt. Because he saw the Chorban of Hellenism in his own father. His father was righteous. His father was a tzaddik. His father was Kohen Gadol. And his father became a tzaduki. Tzadukim were very connected to Hellenistic influences.
All right.
So in a sense, that itself might have been what energized him to do what he did. So it's fascinating. Now, again, as I say, I can't... I mean, just because I like this thought doesn't mean I can say that it's right. I mean, the Rambam, in fact, says it's not true. The Rambam himself says that it's the other way around, that Yochanan was the one who made the takanos. Matisyahu's father made the takanos. He's called the Bala Takanos. But the Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who became the tzaduki, is a descendant when the Hasmoneans already became. In fact, the Hasmonean king that is known in English as John Hyrcanus. That is the Yochanan Kohen Gadol who became the tzaduki, right? So there's a lot of confusion. Now, I'm going to end with one other thing that will confuse you even more. This is going to be a totally new bit of information that I never mentioned before, and I don't know if you heard this before. There are actually some that say that there was a man called Chashmonai. In other words, Chashmonai is not just describing Matisyahu and Yochanan, but the way you read the Al-Hanisim is this. In the days of Matisyahu ben Yochanan, Kohen Gadol, Kama, and Chashmonai Ubanav, and a man called Chashmonai and his children. So some actually say that the Maccabee revolt was conducted by two families, Matisyahu and his five sons, and Chashmonai and his sons. Now, if that's the case, that makes this man Chashmonai really a very unknown hero, because essentially, the way we normally translate Al-Hanisim, Chashmonai is an adjective going back on Matisyahu, when in fact there was a man called Chashmonai. And this could explain a lot of stiras, because let me explain something very quickly where we're running a little late. And that is the Book of Maccabees tells us Matisyahu had five sons. And yet, Rashi in Zos HaBracha talks about 12 Chashmonai. And there's a third Medrash that talks about 7 Chashmonai. So we have three numbers, a 5, a 12, and a 7. But if you posit Matisyahu and Chashmonai are two different people, then the numbers work out perfectly. Matisyahu had 5 sons. Chashmonai had 7 sons. Together, there were 12 sons who were leading the revolt. This is a totally new perspective, that there actually is a fellow called Chashmonai who was a co-leader of the revolt. Now, the only question I have is, I'm not sure why Matisyahu's descendants would be known as the Chashmonaim. So why is it called the Hasmonean monarchy? I mean, the first king of the Hasmoneans was Shimon, the son of Matisyahu. But if you're telling me Hashmonai is a different person, I'm not sure why it's called the Malchus of Hashmonai. So that's a bit of a question that I have, and that identification. And in fact, in some Gersas of the Al Nisim, there's above there, Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol v'Hashmonai Ubanan. So there for sure you see it's Kadima, but even without the Vav, you can just look at it as a sequence. So that's, I don't know exactly what to do with that, but it's a piece of information. That's a very, very interesting bit of information. Okay, you all be well. Have a Chanukah Sameach. And, take care.